Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, professor of religious studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock.
And I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, director of lifelong learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we discuss the two healing stories in Luke 7, 1-17. We struggle with the story of Jesus healing a man enslaved by a Roman centurion. If Jesus is supposed to let the oppressed go free, why does he restore this man to his enslaver? Shouldn't we expect more than that from Jesus? And we ponder Jesus' resurrection of a widow's son, recognizing here the Jesus who acts out of mercy and compassion rather than social expectation. And we wonder, how can we reconcile these two stories of healing, and what do they mean for us today? Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this week?
I am doing all right. How are you?
I'm okay. Yeah, I'm good.
So yesterday I went for a walk with my rabbi and we went for a walk. And on my way back, I came to this main intersection and there were all these very exuberant young people that had signs that said, honk if you love Jesus.
Yeah, they did.
And so one of them turned towards me and like we made eye contact and I was like, you are so cute and I love that you're doing this. And I think Jesus is cool, but I don't think that I love him the way that you mean. So I don't think that I'm meant to honk.
Yeah.
And I was like, how is this going to end? Like, locked eyes with this sweet young thing. And finally, he pointed at me with like both hands and said like so enthusiastically, God loves you. And it was I found it to be so cute.
I'm so glad you found it to be cute because that can sometimes go sideways. So
yes, I could see how another maybe Jewish person or non-Christian person in that situation would not like that.
Yeah.
But I thought it was really sweet.
Yeah, that's great.
Sweet. I thought it was sweet.
It was reminding me kind of that interaction was reminding me a little bit of like middle school. And when you have to have that conversation, like, I like you, I just don't like you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's like your relationship with Jesus.
Like,
I like you. But I don't like you enough to honk in this moment.
Right. 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 I don't want to mislead you.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, good times. Good times driving around Atlanta.
All right, Amy, today we are in Luke chapter 7. Got a couple of really interesting stories. The first about a centurion, and then the second story about a widow and her son. So I'm in chapter 7. I'm going to start out with verses 1-5, and I'm reading in the Common English Bible. After Jesus finished presenting all his words among the people, he entered Capernaum. A centurion had a servant who was very important to him, but the servant was ill and about to die. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders to Jesus to ask him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they earnestly pleaded with Jesus. He deserves to have you do this for him, they said. He loves our people and he built our synagogue for us. Just suddenly we've got a Roman soldier showing up in the Gospel of Luke. Any thoughts about that?
So yeah, this is a Roman soldier who has some power.
Yeah.
Right? This is like an officer who would be in charge of a company of soldiers.
That's right.
Who presumably represents the government, the establishment, the political leadership in some way.
What do you think about this? He built our synagogue for us, and so he deserves your attention. How do you understand what's going on there?
So, I mean, there's a note in the Jewish annotated New Testament that this is one of several historically attested Gentile patrons of synagogues. So apparently this was a thing that happened. Like, it presumably he is not Jewish, but he lives in a Jewish community and supports that community and wants them to be able to worship in the way that they worship. And so is a financial supporter. He's like a Philo-Semite.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think you can read this guy as what's known as a God-fearer, like a Gentile who actually sort of tangentially worships the God of Israel. But I don't think you have to read him that way. I think you can read him as a Roman who practices Roman religion, really has no particular interest religiously in Judaism or the God of Israel, but, as you're saying, is supportive. Like, he's, you know, he lives among the people in Galilee, and so he wants to be supportive of the local culture.
So from the perspective of the Jewish elders, the fact that the centurion is supportive of their community would be something to give him merit in Jesus's eyes.
Yeah.
But from the perspective of Jesus, as far as we know it so far, Jesus didn't care about that. Like, Jesus is here not just for people who have supported the Jewish community, and certainly not just for people who have the financial means to build a synagogue, and certainly not for the powerful soldiers who own slaves. Like, I just feel like there are so many things in this story that I was like, wait, Jesus is going to, I thought we just said that, I would have said this is the story where Jesus says, like, no, you are the powerful and you're going to get overturned and you're going to see what it's like to be brought low. But that's not at all what happens.
I mean, what's happening here seems like is a like Roman patronage system in which, you know, somebody with some means and power has done something for the Jewish elders. And so they're in his debt. And so the way that they're sort of repaying the debt is to go and use their connections to Jesus in order to have this slave healed. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're exactly right. Like, Luke has been talking about upending this system of people with power and influence are owed, you know, things from people. And here Jesus, I don't know if he, I mean, he plays along with it. It's not entirely clear that he affirms it, but he certainly doesn't.
He doesn't overturn it.
Reject it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the presenting issue in this text is that the centurion has a, in the CEB, it's a servant. In the Greek, it's doulos, which more plainly just means a slave. So he has a slave who is sick and near death. And so the Jewish elders are intervening, asking Jesus to heal the centurion's slave, who really isn't a character in this text, like, at all. So I don't know. This is a complicated, there's a complicated set of things going on here. But when you read about this centurion's slave, where does your head go?
I mean, last week we talked about in the healing of the person in the synagogue who had a right hand that was withered.
Yeah.
We used the very strong word pawn. Like, it seemed a little bit like what was happening. I mean, it was for him, but it was, he was a little bit of a pawn in the story. And in this story, I see it all the more so, like the pawn, but mixing in all of these power dynamics with it. You know, he's a slave whom he valued highly. Like, I don't know. It just feels so like he had a human possession that he really liked, and he didn't want to lose his human possession. And so he went to, you know, he wanted to see if Jesus would help make that happen. I don't know if that's too much of an edge to put on it. I mean, maybe he had some human affection for this person and it wasn't just a, you know, it wasn't just economic, certainly. But the whole thing just makes me very, it makes me very uncomfortable.
And, you know, you have read in Luke chapter 4, like, Jesus is coming to set the oppressed free. And so you think, oh, here's the opportunity for Jesus to set somebody free. And he doesn't mention it at all. He affirms the system in its own way. Okay, so when they come to Jesus, they tell him about the slave and they say that this guy is a nice guy who's done some good things for our community. He deserves your help. And so Jesus, in verse 6, goes with them. He had almost reached the house when the centurion sent friends to say to Jesus, Lord, don't be bothered. I don't deserve to have you come under my roof. In fact, I didn't even consider myself worthy to come to you. Just say the word and my servant will be healed. I'm also a man appointed under authority with soldiers under me. I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and the servant does it. When Jesus heard these words, he was impressed with the centurion. He turned to the crowd following him and said, I tell you, even in Israel, I haven't found faith like this. When the centurion's friends returned to his house, they found the servant restored to health. So here we have the centurion. He has sent one delegation, which has succeeded in its task of getting Jesus to come. Mm-hmm. And then he sends another delegation saying, no, I actually didn't want you to come.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you make of the centurion's telling Jesus, please don't come to my house?
Well, first, while he says, I didn't presume to come to you.
Yeah.
It also stands out to me that, like, this is a powerful soldier who just keeps sending other people to be his messenger. So, again, there's, like, this, I don't know, it's hard for me not to read this story as, like, you're a rich, powerful soldier sitting on your couch, sending people back and forth to try to get your slave healed. Like, I don't know. Get up and go yourself. Like, get up.
Yeah.
The only way that it makes sense to me is that he didn't mean for Jesus to physically come. He meant for Jesus to heal from afar.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you read it differently? I mean, can it make sense for him to change his mind?
Because it says in verse 3, he sent some Jewish elders to ask him to come and heal his servant. Right?
Yeah, it does say that.
It sort of is suggested there.
It's suggested strongly.
And so I don't know if there's a changing of mind or just a lack of clarity about what this thing's going to entail.
It could just be the realization that, like, wait, why are you schlepping all the way out here? Like, you've got a remote control healing system. Like, you don't have to come here.
Yeah, when trying to read think about the centurion's motivations about not wanting Jesus to take the trouble to come to his house, whether he intends that from the beginning or whether he changes his mind in the middle. And one is that this Roman centurion who, you know, is at the top of the power pyramid and the dignity, the honor pyramid, is saying to Jesus, at the very least, like, I recognize you as someone sort of on my level in terms of honor and respect. And I don't feel like I have the authority to tell you to do anything. So, you know, he's a little bit lowering himself to Jesus here and saying Jesus' authority is above his own.
I love the way that you said that he's at the top of the honor pyramid in the human realm.
Yeah.
And he is oriented I haven't served in the military, but at least the military on TV, the folks who are involved are really oriented towards those structures and that sort of hierarchy of power. And it's important to them to relate to people within that context.
Yeah.
You know? And so I do see here a sense that he is at the top in the human realm, but he recognizes Jesus as being above him and treats him with due honor,
yeah,
I guess, in that way.
Yeah, I think that last point is important, that the Roman centurion is able to see that there is at least some other kind of hierarchy in which Jesus is important or more important than he is, but it's not the Roman social hierarchy. It's some other kind of kingdom of heaven hierarchy or spiritual hierarchy or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a recognition that there are two different kind of sorts of power that one can
wield here. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You would like, based on what you said earlier, you would like for Jesus to not be playing that hierarchy game at all. But Jesus here is sort of a little bit like, yeah, like, this guy gets it.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I read this part of the story as like a person with power understands power.
Yeah.
And invites Jesus to use it.
Yeah.
And Jesus calls that faith.
Yeah.
Like, and just in the same way that we said there's this weird interweaving of power and affection, there's, for me, this weird interweaving of power and faith here.
Yeah.
Which, again, is true. Like, that is a true thing in the world.
Yeah.
But it's sticky.
Yeah, it's really sticky.
It's sticky.
The way the centurion gets at that is he says, look, I have authority in my appointment. I tell people to jump and they jump. And he's suggesting that Jesus has similar authority, that he can tell spirits, he can tell illnesses, he can tell death to go and death will go. And so he's used this sort of command structure as a way of that's how he's thinking about his faith in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus's response is, I tell
you,
even in Israel, I haven't found faith like this. So it is right on, but it's also a comparative right on, right? This is superlative, relative to what I have experienced in Israel. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about the way Jesus responds, like the connection to Israel that Jesus makes there?
So on the one hand, I appreciate that what I can appreciate about what Jesus is saying is that this guy, this centurion, has a much greater imagination of what the capacity of Jesus's power might be.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think that he has that it's not imagination for him. It's because he himself has this kind of power in a way that most of the people of Israel do not, because he's part of the government authority.
Yeah.
So I think sort of saying you're doing so much better than the people of Israel here is a little like, for a gospel that's saying the power structures are going to be overturned, I feel like he only knows this because he's had this really privileged life.
Yeah.
So I don't give him quite as much credit as Jesus does.
One of the things that I noticed in my reading is that Jesus doesn't say, I notice that you have faith in this way and the people of Israel don't. Mm-hmm. He says, even in Israel, which in my mind is like Israel is at the top of the pyramid of all the other things. And then this guy has one up to the top of the pyramid. Mm-hmm. But this isn't exactly derogatory toward the people of Israel. It is like, wow, the people of Israel, there's a lot of faith there. And your faith is even more than that faith. So it's relativizing them, but it's not a purely negative assessment.
That's true.
Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I do think that's fair. Part of what Jesus is so glad about in the centurion's recognition that he can do this remotely, he can do it just by having the intention for the person to be healed. It seems through these stories like Jesus can only, well, I don't know. I'll say this and then tell me if it's wrong. Jesus can only heal people. Jesus can only do things effectively if the person believes that he can. Like the degree of faith that the person is willing to put in him impacts how much Jesus can do. So in some ways, the centurion saying, of course you can do this remotely, Jesus is like, oh, thank goodness, now I can finally do this remotely, but I needed you to believe that I could.
So first, I just have to say that, like, your use of the word remotely is like, oh, this is like Jesus was working from home. Like,
like we've been doing Zoom remote healing.
This is the, like, pandemic version of the Messiah. You just stay where you are and heal people. And that's awesome.
Oh, dear.
It is definitely true. Like, we had that story last year in the Gospel of Mark where Jesus was in Nazareth and he literally, it says he could not heal people there because they didn't believe in him. So that's definitely in the Gospels. Whether that's in Luke or not is less clear to me. And the next story we're going to read, I think, sort of plays into this question about to what degree is faith important. I think it does seem to be the case that the fact that the centurion has this belief about Jesus or trust in Jesus, I don't know if it enables Jesus to do something he otherwise couldn't do, or it sort of gives him permission to do something. But it is true, like if Jesus could have just healed the slave without, like he could have just done that 5 minutes ago.
Right.
You know,
I mean, surely he knew he could do that.
Yeah. So it's interesting that he didn't until this centurion says, I know you can do this. And then he's like, oh yeah, okay, I can do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, when you put on your Hebrew Bible hat, does this story connect you any place?
Well, I'm cheating a little bit because the next story is of the miraculous healing of the son of a widow, which makes me think of Elijah healing or resurrecting, we're not quite sure, the son of a widow who is herself not Jewish.
Yeah. No, I think that text is definitely in the background, especially of this next section that we're about to read, the raising of the son. I think 1 Kings 17 is right in line there. This text reminds me of the story of Elisha and the Syrian soldier, Naaman, in 2 Kings 5. So here you have a Israelite Jewish prophet, and you have a Gentile soldier. You have these kind of in-between figures. You've got the Israelite girl who tells Naaman about Elisha. You've got the Jewish elders who tell Jesus, or who tell the centurion about Jesus. You've got a healing that takes place at a distance. So when Naaman comes to see Elisha, Elisha never comes to the door. He's he sends his servant, and they never see each other face to face. And then he sends Naaman to wash in the river, and then he's healed. So they never actually see each other. Here you've got a story, too, where Jesus never sees the centurion. He's healed at a distance. Do you think that is a legitimate sort of comparison?
I do think it's a legitimate comparison. And now so then we have these two healing stories back to back that resonate so strongly with healing stories of Elijah and Elisha. Why?
So we have talked about both of these stories quite recently.
We have.
In the story of Jesus preaching at Nazareth and saying, reading that passage from Isaiah 61 and saying, truly I tell you. And then he tells the story of Naaman and he tells the story of the widow at Zarephath. And then here he is, three chapters later, reenacting the story of Naaman. And then in just a second, he's going to reenact the story of Elijah at Zarephath. And so in my mind, what's happened is we have been set up in chapter 4 to say, in Jesus' sermon, to say, this is what prophets do, and this is what the liberation of the oppressed is going to look like in Jesus' ministry. And then three chapters later, here it is, like Jesus is just doing the things he said back in his sermon in Nazareth.
Yeah, and I mean, by doing these miraculous acts that mirror miracles that have already happened, it's sort of like Jesus is, he's demonstrating that he has power that seems akin to Elijah and Elisha, although we'll read in the next story, I think it does sort of one-up Elijah.
Yeah.
But those things already happened.
Yeah.
So presumably, there will be more to it.
Well, let's go ahead and read that second story, and then we can continue to ponder this conversation that we're having.
Yeah.
So the second part of the story involves Jesus in a resurrection of a widow's son in verses 11 to 17. A little later, Jesus went to a city called Nain. His disciples and a great crowd traveled with him. As he approached the city gate, a dead man was being carried out. He was his mother's only son, and she was a widow. A large crowd from the city was with her. When he saw her, the Lord had compassion for her and said, "Don't cry." He stepped forward and touched the stretcher on which the dead man was being carried. Those carrying him stood still. Jesus said, "Young man, I say to you, get up." The dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him to his mother. Awestruck, everyone praised God. "A great prophet has appeared among us," they said. "God has come to help his people." This news about Jesus spread throughout Judea and the surrounding region.
Yeah, I bet it did.
Okay, so, well, you said a minute ago that Jesus one-ups Elijah here, and I'm just really interested in what you mean by that. Where do you see the one-upsmanship?
So, like the Elijah story, he revives the son of a widow.
Yeah.
Right? The one-upsmanship, I guess I would say, is he doesn't know this widow. Like, Elijah was living with the widow.
Yeah.
The widow asked him pretty directly to intervene, or at least complained that this was happening, and he had not intervened.
Yeah.
And this widow doesn't say anything to Jesus. And he just speaks to this dead person.
Mm-hmm.
And Elijah does this weird, like, full body CPR situation. There's a lot of physicality.
Yeah, and a lot of kind of, like, strong, like, almost pleading with God to do the healing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Jesus just says, get up. Yeah.
Yeah, in some ways, this reads to me like, if Elijah did a miracle, then, like, all the more so did Jesus.
Now, you are noticing Jesus's relationship to this widow. I mean, which is basically, he doesn't have any. He sees her. There's a funeral procession, and it just says Jesus saw her, had compassion for her, and said, "Don't cry."
Mm-hmm.
Do you have thoughts about what motivates Jesus here?
I mean, I think there is something really powerful in seeing someone else's suffering. And I think the fact that Jesus actually encounters the funeral procession and sees this weeping widow moves him.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
Like, do you read this as he's compassionate because she has lost a dear loved one, or because of something about the status of a widow? Like, the text is very clear to say, so first of all, she's a widow, so she has no husband.
Yeah.
And secondly, that this was her only son, so she now has no son. Is it something about her particular status, you think? Or just like someone who's experienced a loss?
I mean, if this weren't coming right off the story that it came right off of, I would say, yes, It's sort of, if you feel compassion for anyone who has lost a child, all the more so would you for a widow who has no husband and no other children. She has no other people. And so this is a great act of compassion for her, you know, again, as in the last story, much more so than we don't know anything about the person who's died. You know, like he's a prop in this story.
Yeah.
The story is about the survivor. The story is about the widow.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like maybe the juxtaposition of these two stories shows a little more of like the spectrum of where Jesus is acting, from the most powerful to the most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I have to imagine that it is important to our understanding of her situation that the text is very clear that she's a widow and she has nobody else.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And the juxtaposition of these two stories, I think, I love the way you're reading that. So we've seen on the one hand, Jesus sort of follows the social hierarchies and does the things that need to be done, which was kind of unexpected. Mm-hmm. And then this healing, in the sense, kind of has the things that we were looking for in the previous one. Like, this is a vulnerable member of society. She doesn't have any power. She's lost her son. So there's an emotional aspect. There's also a financial aspect mm-hmm. here. Like, she is really quite a vulnerable person. We don't know her financial status, but having no husband, no son, she runs the risk anyway of being in a vulnerable position with no one to, no sort of social assurance or financial assurance around her. Mm-hmm. And so this seems to be the kind of person Jesus was talking about in Luke chapter 4 when mm-hmm. he said he's going to, you know, preach good news to the poor.
Yeah, and I feel like I need to underscore here, it doesn't do anything to dismantle anything that you've said, but that she is, I mean, she's going out in this funeral procession with a large crowd from the town.
Yeah.
The human community is supporting her in the way that they can. But, and Jesus can do more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, that's kind of where it's going in my own mind, is like, social safety nets are great. Like, and there is a system in the Jewish mm-hmm. Torah that looks out for people like her, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this mm-hmm. is part of the communal ethos mm-hmm. is attention, care for the widow, the orphan, the stranger. That's mm-hmm. that's built into it. And also, those people are still vulnerable, mm-hmm. even though there is a social safety net, because mm-hmm. you have to rely on the sufficiency of the social safety net.
Right. And this, and as far as we can tell, the safety net here is working.
Yeah.
It's not that it's not working. It's that it has limits.
Yeah. And the same is true of our own social safety nets.
Yes.
We're glad they're there. They have their mm-hmm. limits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the people see what has happened, they say, "A great prophet has appeared among us. God has come to help his people." What significance do you attribute to what they've said there?
I mean, the use of the word prophet makes me wonder if they're also thinking of Elijah and Elisha and mm-hmm. that kind of miraculous healing. And it makes me sort of think back historically to, like, when was the last one? Like, when was the last holy man, as these figures are also called, that this community has experienced, but that they recognize that something new is happening. Like, God has come, has shown up in a way that God was not there before, in that mm-hmm. kind of like localized way inside the body of a person who does miracles.
So another thing that you might notice is in the CEB, the translation is, "A great prophet has appeared among us." The Greek there is actually egeiro, which means to be raised up, which might remind you of Deuteronomy 18, where Moses said, "God will raise up another prophet like me." And so I think that might be in the background of this text, is that idea that mm-hmm. this prophet Jesus is being, I don't know if the people are understanding, like, it's pretty subtle, but I think Luke is trying to make that connection that this prophet is the prophet that Moses anticipated all the way back in Deuteronomy.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that connection. I love that. I mean, because the singularity of Moses in the history of the prophets, especially at this moment of transition and journey and, you know, like moving into a new form of peoplehood that is happening at that time in Deuteronomy, I can imagine that Luke absolutely would want to put that in our minds.
Now, one of the things that you were talking about in the centurion story earlier was the question of whether Jesus can perform miracles when people don't believe.
Yeah.
And I think this text suggests that in fact he can.
I think that's right.
I think it's important in this text that the woman's faith has nothing whatsoever to do with this healing, mm-hmm. at least in any way we can tell. And in the previous story, it was Jesus saying, even in Israel, I haven't seen such great faith. And then he performs the healing. Mm-hmm. But here it's purely Jesus's compassion, Jesus's mercy that makes this healing happen. And that seems like that contrast seems important. Like, so faith does have value, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. also like this whole other trajectory of sometimes Jesus is just merciful. Mm-hmm. Do you do anything with that?
I'm really glad that you pointed that out. And it pushed me back in the text again to look at her response after her son is risen. And she doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
I mean, we can certainly read her relief or her joy into the story, but it doesn't say anything. The man is given to his mother and then the people respond, but it doesn't say... She doesn't make a proclamation of faith.
Yeah.
She doesn't say anything.
And I love that the woman doesn't ever say anything, because if she had said, I knew you could do it, or whatever she mm-hmm. said, then we would be able to say, well, it was actually her faith that motivated Jesus. We just didn't know it till the end.
Yeah.
And the fact that the text completely withholds that just says, I mean, like, it really pushes the point that her faith has nothing to do with it. It is purely Jesus's mercy that affects this healing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Amy, so this brings us to the end of our conversation. So when you think about these two texts and their connection to contemporary life, where is your head going?
My head is going to the fact that these revivals are so focused on the living, like the person you would have left behind, not on the dead. And that poor person died and we want to bring them back for their own sake. And it just makes me reflect again on something that is deeply true of my experience as a human in the world, of how interconnected our lives are and how deeply the living are affected when someone dies. And so, I mean, this takes me in various directions, but one of them that's on my mind right now is, have you heard of the writer Jennifer Michael Hecht?
I don't know her.
No, she wrote a book called Stay. The subtitle is A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. And the main point that she drives home in her book is that our lives and our deaths are inextricably tied up with other people's. And so as much as we might think of our, like, my life is my life and I do with my life what I want to do with my life. And, you know, this sort of, we talk often about it on this podcast, about our sense as Americans of our independence and our individual, I don't know, our individual salvation and our individual path and our individual choices.
Yeah.
And her point that she makes really eloquently is that that's not true. Like, you know, like there are no clean borders like that between human lives, and the ways that we live and the ways that we die have tremendous reverberations in our communities. And so the way that Jesus touches these individuals or communities is in a way indirect. Like, it's not through something that we would point to as, say, like, that's their life, but he impacts the people that he wants to impact through someone else's life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's a true thing. That's true. And I prefer it very much to thinking about the dead in these stories as being pawns for what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
That's where my head goes. That's where my head goes.
I love that. So in a sense, these are stories about restoration of relationship and community as much as they are stories about the raising of particular individuals.
Yeah, I think so. Where does your head take you when you read these stories?
I have very different responses to these two texts.
Yeah.
I love the second story here, the raising of the widow's son, for a lot of the reasons that we've talked about. And, you know, my main takeaway here is that Jesus, in this case, is motivated by compassion for someone who is suffering. Mm-hmm. That suffering is both personal, the loss of a loved one, and also societal, economic, the vulnerability in a society that privileges certain kinds of people. And Jesus recognizes all of that vulnerability and is just moved by compassion to intervene in that situation, not because she was faithful, not because she deserved it, not even because she asked for it, but just because Jesus was moved. Mm-hmm. And I think that is just such a beautiful image of what Jesus is like, what God is like, what we could be like, where we don't ask about the deservingness of a person before we try to act. We don't, you know, set up, you know, you've got to say this before I do that or whatever.
Right.
But just here is somebody who is in need and let me act with compassion toward that person. The other story of the centurion to me, like I have a lot of the same troubles with it that you were kind of raising about the interplay of power and hierarchy and privilege and social status, the ignoring of the status of the slave who is, I mean, great, he's been healed, but he's been healed and restored to a slavery situation rather than being set free. I struggle so much with that story. And some of the things that we were saying earlier about when you struggle with that story, you also can recognize things in our own culture, in our own lives that we need to struggle with. Like,
yes,
that's what that story does for me, is it's kind of a diagnostic tool about like, when am I responding to people because there's some social expectation that I should, or when am I responding to people because I know that if I respond to this person, like it could be good for me as a human or good for my career or whatever. Like, how am I making the choices? How am I exercising my privilege? How am I responding to people in positions of power? And sort of paying attention in my own life, and I think in the lives of our communities, about, can we be more about the responding in compassion because people need compassion, rather than responding because there is social dictates surrounding our response? Can we be more like the second one of these stories than like the first one of these stories, is kind of where my head goes.
The first story does serve in some ways as a corrective to me, because I keep reading it and saying, like, no, Jesus is not going to do that. Like, this is what Jesus doesn't do.
Yeah.
Be like, Amy, you don't get to tell Jesus what to do. Like, Jesus is not in a box. You don't get to systematize things that, you know, like, it stands as a corrective to me that sort of like, it's more complicated than I think it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a tough one. It's a tough one.
Yeah. And I think that's always what you're saying there, I think, is always helpful, especially for those of us for whom this is a religious text, that like the stories and the God who lies behind the stories are always surprising us in ways that sometimes are very pleasing to us and sometimes are very troubling
sometimes
to us.
Yeah.
But we ought to let ourselves be troubled and think about what that means, not just about the text, but also about ourselves. Yeah.
About us.
All right, Amy, so next time we're going to be in Luke chapter 9. We're going to get the story of the Mountain of Transfiguration. And then also another healing. It's going to be good times.
That sounds great. I enjoyed it.
Me too.
I'll
see you next time.
Week. Okay. Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We are so grateful to all our supporters for helping us to keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois, and to our newest sponsor, Joanna Mitchell.
Join us next week when we'll be discussing Luke 9, 28-45, the stories of Jesus' transfiguration on the mountain and casting a spirit out of a young boy. Until then, keep on digging.